Well, welcome everybody. My name is Joe Fattorini. We have this extraordinary panel. Anne Jones from Waitrose. Go to LinkedIn because you'll find her extraordinary CV. And you are on the MW program, aren't you?
I am, yes, for my sins.
And then Barry Dick, who's alongside, who was on the MW program with me. But Barry got it and I didn't. And I'm not in any way bitter about it.
That was definitely nothing to do with brains, Joe.
So Barry, you're going to give us lots of technical insight and expertise, which is what you used to do for my MW practice essays way back when. And then Ollie Lee, who's come from the Bibb Wine Company, which we are delighted because you are having experience as a startup in alternative packaging and consumer acceptance. Unbeknownst to possibly quite a lot of people here, I'm now a winemaker. And I run a 3.4 hectare estate in southern Spain. We are producing a certain amount of wine there, but we are looking to produce actually something slightly different, something more than you would get out of 3.4 hectares. If anybody's very interested, look up the hashtag A Wish Called Rhonda, because it's also being made into a TV show. As a small independent producer, this is from as a sort of kickoff. I'd love to go and get your perspectives from the sort of three of you as to what somebody like me ought to be doing to get consumers to accept alternative packaging. And I'm going to start with Ollie, because you do work with small independent producers in alternative packaging, don't you?
We do. And I think it raises a really interesting fact. I think it's that in the wine industry, I think we often look for who has responsibility, who bears the responsibility of progressing sustainability, and especially when we're talking about alternative packaging. And I actually think it's really tricky. It's a really difficult subject if you try and put that responsibility on small independent winemakers, because many of them are struggling to sell their wine in the first place. They've got an awful lot on. Smaller winemakers are handling every aspect of the business. It's a huge job. And to then say, well, you've actually got to change the way you do it, when it comes to packaging, you know, strip out your bottling line or break your connection with your mobile bottler and do it a different way. And, you know, do it a way that's quite unknown at the moment, you know, that we're still getting to grips with. And then take that product and market it and market the wine and the alternative packaging. And I think that's probably not where the responsibility lies. I actually think the responsibility lies much further down the chain with the people selling the wine to the end consumer and, you know, to a certain extent to the consumer, with the consumer themselves.
So Anne, you're further down the line. You're the one responsible for selling it to the consumer. Do you take on this responsibility that Ollie has very politely given you?
I think we do, up to a point. I think we completely understand that there's a collective responsibility here. This has to be a consensus, because we've trained customers over so long into certain decisions and certain ways of thinking about wine that there's got to be a totemic cultural shift. And yes, we as retailers have a responsibility to that. But as one retailer, you know, we're one supermarket with a 5% market share overall. There's only so much we can do to change that cultural direction. So that's why it's all very well to say, oh, it's everyone's responsibility. Those are lofty words. But that is exactly why we have come to something like the FWR, where I think we can start to form a collective and we can actually hopefully make some genuine change that impacts enough people, has enough touch points across the value chain and with enough consumers that actually we can move on. I would also say, though, that I genuinely think we need to be looking outside the wine industry as well.
Now, I was sort of odd perspective. I'm a Spanish winemaker who lives in Sweden, but in Sweden there's huge consumer acceptance of alternative packaging, well, particularly boxes. But of course, that's because it's a monopoly, and essentially, it's imposed upon people. Is that what you need as a retailer? Is somebody essentially say, well, I'm actually taking this choice out of your hands?
Yeah, so there's either regulation. There is regulation. But one of the questions I've got about those monopoly countries is actually whether the stuff that's not sold in bag and box. I think we've got a real issue over premiumization and premium acceptance. And Erica and I were chatting about this earlier, about you know, top end wines that are still going to be in glass and who can't see any other way. I feel as though we talk about alternative packaging, but actually it's not really alternatives. It's can or bag in box or bag in bottle, or pouches maybe. But actually it shouldn't be beyond the wit of man to come up with something else. But I'm sitting here with a Chili's bottle. You know, there are thousands and thousands of other industries working really hard on this technology, and maybe the answer is not in our hands yet.
To get us right round, Barry, you're our technical specialist, and in fact you have made your own brand in alternative and bottle. What would be your, you know, where would you like to see this go? What would be technically the perfect packaging in a sustainable format?
I kind of view, you know, I think bag and box is, you know, it's like your point about Sweden. You know, there's a lot of history of using bag and box and seeing the benefits of it. You know, so I think bag and box offers the large format. It's a great solution. You know, it's been around for quite a long time. It works really well. You know, cans are also, you know, work really well technically, and they, you know, they're used in different categories. The consumers or our customers are pretty used to grabbing a can of, you know, a mixed cocktail or a soft drink, and, you know, and I think increasingly so a glass of wine. So I think that between that and the glass bottle at the minute, that's a lot of occasions, wine drinking occasions covered. So I do think we've got some great solutions in play. There will be some things, as Anne says, I think new technology that comes through. I haven't seen anything, you know, that radically, you know, is different technically from those three options at the minute. But I think, you know, they definitely may come. Reusable stuff, reusable glass or a hardened PET may also be part of a solution in the future, but not right now. But as I say, I think between bag and box and large format and can and small, you know, lighter weight glass in standard format, we got some good bases covered.
Interesting. One thought I've had around this, and this is perhaps more a sort of marketing question, but actually, Barry, I'll start with you anyway, because you've got insights into all of this. Some years ago, I think it was the first time I was involved in one of these events, I think Jancis even wrote about it, and I kept banging on about this thing, as it happens in Sweden, where they reduced the number of people flying internally, essentially by having a word. So they invented a word, which was flygskam, which translates as flight shame. And that becomes a thing. People become ashamed of taking internal flights. And of course, they invented a counter, which was talk script, was pride in taking the train. So people would put it on social media and they would say, you know, a fleet scam means I'm not going to take it. And I remember saying, maybe we need to have sort of flasker scam. Technically, it sounds as though alternative packaging, more environmentally sustainable packaging, is kind of there. You know, it's around. It's more just a question of getting people to accept it, certainly as people become more premium. I mean, are there things you're seeing from your perspective where people are going, actually, I will go and have a more expensive bottle of wine, but in a can, in a pouch, in a bag and box?
I think that concept of, you know, and what that word did is suddenly raise consciousness, you know, in the consumer about, you know, the impact of taking a flight. And I think that's kind of what we need to do with alternative formats and glass. I've seen some really cool stuff about, you know, carbon footprints being accessible, and you can make comparable informed decisions when you're comparing a glass bottle with a bag and box or a can. And I think when we get to that point, and that will be right across the grocery, you know, grocery categories. And I think one day you'll get to the till and it will be that, hi, Joe, that was 100 quid. And FYI, your carbon footprint was this. And I think then, you know, as we, you know, responding to the climate crisis, you know, as Anne said, it's about all of us doing our bit. And I think as a retailer, you know, in a role in a retailer, I've got to do my bit to influence my business in the right direction. You know, we've also set our course so I can do my bit, but also, you know, our customers and the consumers need to do their bit as well. And I think with the right information, that really empowers them to be able to do their bit. And I think that's kind of where we'll get to is, you know, all of those decisions that we're making, we'll understand the impact. And I think we will, you know, we will really start to inform and alter our behaviour.
And whilst you're putting your headphones back on, okay, I'm wondering if we can possibly persuade. Maybe this would help. Maybe this really wouldn't. You know, could we persuade the Waitrose Wine Marketing Department to go and run a social media campaign called something like Decant Your Boxes, where you presented wines that come in alternative formats that are often seen as being at the bottom end of the food chain, if you like, but presenting them as a, no, you can go and decant this and serve it at a smart dinner party. I mean, you would be the one retailer to really try this with, because it would sort of hit middle England straight between the eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's actually about persuading customers that the wines that are in bag-in-box are drinkable. I think in some ways we've got there. We've got some really good wines, and actually helped by some amazing brands that we had a lot of loyalty with moving into cans and boxes. I think the question really is where we're talking about premiumization. I think that kind of, £8 to £10 bottle, if it were a 70cl bottle, that kind of wine in bag-in-box, I think we can move that on just by creating more visibility. And yes, maybe there is some kind of discussion to be had about something more creative in terms of the marketing solution. But I think what's concerning me, but I still am not convinced that we're going to persuade everybody either to get a decanter or to put a bag-in-box on the table for dinner party. It's the mission-led, occasion-driven stuff that I'm not sure we've quite got the right format for yet. And I think the right format for that will come. But that's the occasion and the mission that I think customers still revert back to glass for. But maybe we just flog everyone, give everyone in the country a free decanter, and then we're done. That'll sort the glass people out. They'll be delighted. We're not going to sell any more bottles, but just make decanters. It'll be fine.
Does it need some sort of shock and awe? I remember Maynard James Keenan from Tool, if anybody's massively into metal. He once showed me, it was a sort of skin-fermented vermentino that he made kind of naturally. And I said, what are you going to do with it? And he said, I think I'm going to put this in cans, which seemed like the most extreme wine. But then it sort of made sense. Of all the things he could have chosen, he's got lots of kind of more orthodox wines. No, let's put the weirdest wine I've got in a can. Because then it kind of shocks people into a kind of weird acceptance. I don't know whether we need to see more of that.
We need to see some first growths in alternative packaging, and then and start to fill in the gap in between those spaces. I don't know if you've been seeing any of the questions, but there's some quite interesting.
There are some good ones. We're going to go and jump over some of those. Well, I might even sort of do a few bits. Now, Ollie, you've been working on boxes. What's your opinion of new paper bottles?
I mean, I think they're great. Broadly speaking, I'm pretty pro all new alternative formats that provide a benefit when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. So, if there's a format that Bibwine isn't doing that gets great acceptance within the consumer market, then that's a great thing. I think we could make a huge mistake waiting for the format that fits the right circumstance. That actually what we need to do now is tell people that all these formats are better. And in doing so, I think we have to accept that, this is the really hard thing for the industry, that there will be a loser in this, and that there should be a loser in this. Glass bottles being used for wines that don't need cellar aging is not a great thing. And that's when it comes back to your flight shaming. Actually, this is where we need to educate. We need to educate on retailers' shelves, on websites, as an industry, looking outwards in newspapers, wherever it might be. We need to make sure that people know, because it's actually the people not knowing what the better format is in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, which is doing us damage. And also some of those have, extra details. I think we see lots of initiatives which are potentially not done for the right reasons. I think it's not helpful to the greater good of wine sustainability to be releasing, say a bottle that's 100% recycled, but is actually 600 grams and, has a carbon footprint the same as or more than a normal bottle or a lighter bottle. So that's really complicating the issue for consumers. We need to make it simple for them.
I think, as Barry mentioned, the devil's in the data, isn't it? And actually, the more we have to report on scope 3 and things, because it's regulatory, then the more information will be available to customers. And I would hope that you would be able to see benefit from that.
Yeah. I think, Barry, as well, that... sorry, Joe, I was just going to say, I think, we have to also just start working with what we have at the moment. There isn't really time to wait, and we have to get the messaging out there, and we have to accept that sometimes there's imperfect data. I love the idea of having life cycle analysis, carbon footprints on every product. But at the same time, we have to understand that you know, a winemaker with 3.5 hectares is, you know, is going to struggle to get an LCA done, or at least if they do, it's going to have a much bigger financial impact on their unit costs. So, you know, we have to look at the bigger numbers and what we already know. It's not like it's a, you know, maybe it's been an open secret, but it's pretty well known, the reality of this, and the reality that the manufacturing and recycling, you know, importantly, and recycling of glass bottles is really harmful when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions.
Apparently, MW paper 2 question, paper bottles, good, bad, or, you know, paper bottles, discuss. What would be your examiner's sort of answer on something like that?
Look, I mean, I think it's kind of a 75cl bag and boxy type shape. So that they, you know, as Ollie said, the benefit there is just on a slightly smaller, you know, standard size. So I think technically and environmentally, you know, it's comparable to pro rata bag and box in a smaller version.
Brilliant. Well, Kristen, thank you very much indeed for that question. I feel now rather like I'm sort of at question time and I'm sort of doling these out. We have Rupert Joy, who says there's a view among some smaller UK pioneers in alt-wine packaging that they're having to shoulder most of the burden in nudging consumers, and that the larger retailers could be doing much more, much faster. We sort of touched on this, and should you be doing much more, much faster?
I think we want to do more faster, and I think what we do has a much greater impact than the smaller people, because we've got a much greater audience. But because of that, we've also got a much greater responsibility, and what we can't do is do something and then find out a little bit later that the data we've been using isn't credible, or that it's been driven by an ulterior motive, or that it's one producer doing one thing. And that is exactly why Barry and I are so committed to doing things like SWR, because through this, we are working with other retailers, we're getting the global context, we're getting a really good third party ratification of the data that we've got, and we're getting a really good understanding of what the best thing to do. And as Oliver said, we can't let perfect get in the way of good. We have to be looking at what we can do now based on the information that we have, and therefore, knowing that it's going to be imperfect, we have to have confidence that what we're doing is the best possible solution. And that is why I think having a consensus where retailers can do the same thing, choose the best possible solution right now between us all, and do the same thing, so that we're not going to our supply base and asking them to do something because that's what we're going to communicate to our customers, but actually another big retailer or bigger retailer just down the road is doing something ever so slightly different to the same supply base, to the same customers. It's just that is not going to help anybody if we're all slightly conflicting. So that's why I think we're putting a lot, as much effort as we can, into supporting coming up with something that is both simple enough to communicate to customers, but has enough good data behind it to be really credible and to be trustworthy. That's the thing we have to do. We have to be doing the thing that's right, not the thing that's easy. And we could go out and scream to all our customers to buy X over Y. It doesn't necessarily mean that's the right thing. So that's why we just need to make sure that we're putting enough thought into things, and hopefully then being able to move forward at pace. But you're right, we've got a lot of volume, and we've got a real privilege of being in that middle space between having a lot of kind of power over the supply base, and also having a large volume of customers that we can talk to. And we just have to be aware that, you know, as Spider-Man says, was it Spider-Man? With great power comes great responsibility.
I believe it is Spider-Man. Thanks. Absolutely. I think that's.
I've just quoted from popular culture. Anyone that knows me will know that that is a very rare occurrence.
Rupert, I hope that answers your question. I think it's a good approach, and it's often one of those things that's easy for us to go, oh, you should totally go and do this. And then somebody goes, well, just a minute, have you thought through the logical consequences?
Yeah, and the potential ramifications of getting something wrong are, you know, are huge.
I don't know if anybody's been following up with some interesting, the Kazum Brooks postulate and the Jevons paradox, which is a slightly sort of earlier version. But, you know, often one of the consequences of often energy efficiency measures is that people simply go and use an awful lot more energy. And, you know, I certainly see this. I live in an incredibly well insulated house, which tends to mean that people just walk around in T-shirts and they open the windows to cool it down. And so often energy use doesn't reduce by nearly as much as you'd imagine when houses become more efficient, because people just simply go and use much more energy and they sort of balance it up. I think that's a sort of summary of the Kazoon Brooks postulate, which I quite like saying anyway. The Jevons paradox is rather older. I'm going to go and jump. There's one here for you, Oliver. Erica Lofving says, if anyone has any input regarding bag-in-box perception on the US markets, I'd love to hear it. It's quite different from the US. I have a small perception, which was in the US, people tend to associate with Botabox or Francia, those kind of brands. I'm unaware of a bib wine company, essentially really pretty premium box wine brand, but you may know differently, Oliver.
I think largely speaking, you're right. There are some really interesting small companies out there. I haven't tried their wine, so I can't say for sure, but there are one or two brands, Boxed, and I can't remember the others off the top of my head. But, you know, there's definitely interesting stuff being done there. It's a big country, so there's lots of room for startups. And, you know, I think it's... Melissa Saunders, another master of wine, works in this area as well, and moves quite a lot of premium wine as well in bag and box. So, and Erica's just pointed out that Tablas Creek launched their rosé in a box last year, which is a fairly big deal actually in that market. So, I think the change is afoot in the premium end of the market in the US, but actually what they have is a much wider acceptance in general of the format, and actually premiumization is relatively easy from that starting point. And they're in their percentage of market share is in the 30s, you know, as it is, or more in retail in France, and they've come from a fairly similar place. So, you know, we're a long way behind in the UK, you know, in the regions of, you know, 5% and under. And, you know, one has to ask the question as to why. And I think, you know, for me, the obvious reason is that we had a big false start in the UK, which wasn't quite so keenly felt elsewhere. And then retailers made a sort of collective decision, or made individually the same decision, perhaps, to hide boxed wine away, which means we've got something of a clean slate now, which, you know, should be an advantage. I think as long as the educational piece is done and protectionism doesn't get in the way of that. So yeah, really, you know, I think it is interesting to look abroad and see that it's not just Scandinavians that have been able to get these formats accepted, and actually to see two countries heading, you know, France and the US heading in the direction of premiumization, and seeing that the fact that they started with a sort of lower end product but with a large market share hasn't damaged that approach.
Scandinavians with a communitarian social philosophies. Erica, hopefully that answers some of your question there. And now this is a good one. Mark, I'm actually slightly going to challenge you. So Mark Howard, moving from glass to alternative, e.g. boxes, cans, will help carbon footprints, but surely not if it is then transported halfway around the world. Now, I'm just going to put a small thing in, which is, I seem to remember, I mean, doing some of the sort of math around this, that certainly in old formats of glass, New Zealand, on the whole, was often a more efficient place to bring wine in terms of total carbon emissions than road trucking it from, I think, was it right, south of Lyon, somewhere like that, because the emissions from road trucking were so much higher than the emissions from sea freight bringing it. So actually, the absolute distance is less important. I think I'm coming back now. I'm going to go to you, Anne. I think that's less important than the exact method of how people do this. I mean, am I sort of right, at least in the general format of it's a bit more complicated than simply does it come from the other side of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the mileage is much less important than the method. But I would also refer to Barry as the expert.
Well, Barry, let's go to you and put you on the spot there.
No, exactly. I think, you know, getting to the nub of the complete, you know, you're trying to take a really complex thing and present it to the customer, and it's not, you know, it's not completely straightforward to say that you can't make binary, you know, far away is bad and close is good, and that's where when you have, you know, as I say, the carbon footprint figured out for a particular model of a thing, then you start to be in the game of making really good decisions because you've got some awesome facts to try and figure out what's the best, you know, best thing to do. But I think Ollie made a really good point. There's some you know, there is some research that gives broad brush stuff, and you know, we are at the point at the moment without that real detailed information of, you know, looking at things and making general assumptions about some stuff. So, you know, and I think it is fair to make a general assumption that, you know, as Ollie said, in the UK, we're doing about 4% of bag-in-box, for example. One of the big levers that we can make to improve the carbon footprint of the wine category in the UK is to do a lot more alternative formats. So that's where the biggest, as I say, this is based, you know, as Anne says, we haven't got the, you know, the real granular data on every single product that we sell at Waitrose. But if you were having to press me and make an assumption, then that is going to be where the next biggest gains in terms of reducing our carbon footprint is. It's going to be making that move.
Definitely. And it's down, we were talking about that, how we communicate to customers, because, you know, just saying, putting "it's complicated" on a piece of advertising isn't really going to help anybody. So we've got to come up with messages that are kind of simple and yet also credible. And some of the stuff around bag in box does, at least we know that it's credible, saying, in general, this is better. Please go online to look at the small print.
Am I right in thinking that it is unlikely that, sorry, my phone's going sort of, as long as you can hear me, it's unlikely that somebody would be shipping bag in box from the other side of the world anyway. The chances are what they would be doing would be bringing it in bulk and then packaging it in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, I think even the shelf life problem of, you know, losing 2-3 months, people were moving towards that model anyway, just from a shelf life point of view. And in transit, the bag, things like bag and box got bashed around a bit. So the presentation of your brand was much better if you, you know, packed it close to where you were selling it.
Brilliant. Right. We need to sort of come back to some of these. Erica, we'll come back to you in a sec. Joanna, how can you recycle bag and box? How do you separate the different components? Oliver, it's for you.
It is different in different countries, you know, I think there is work to be done in different areas with different parts. But, you know, I think the key is that fundamentally the whole package is recyclable. Bibwine, for example, takes the bags and taps through a free post return scheme. They go off and use a type of pyrolysis, which is microwave induced and uses crushed carbon particles, which is highly efficient, turns that into feedstock oils that can then go back round in a circular economy and a closed loop and be used again. And that's really the future of difficult to recycle plastic recycling. But there are other schemes available that offer, you know, some of that benefit, whether it's supermarkets accepting these bags as along with their bags, or local councils. And, you know, we have almost 20% of local councils that accept them in their collection. Lots more to be done, but I think it's very worthwhile noting that the recycling of glass bottles is actually really damaging. You know, when we compare bag-in-box format to glass bottles, you know, the best data we have comes from a study which uses an 83% recycled content glass bottle as its reference. That's much higher than is normally achieved. And it doesn't improve as you go from 83 to 100% because the weight of that bottle tends to get bigger, and there just aren't the furnaces that can do that particularly easily. So really, you know, that recycling and continually recycling glass is not doing an awful lot of good. It's doing good if you're only using glass. It's a little bit better than just, you know, virgin glass every time. But it's really part of the problem, not the solution. And I think to get bogged down in improving glass bottle recycling rates is really to invest in what we've been doing and to ignore the climate crisis, which is really based in, you know, which requires a much bigger solution, you know, bigger savings. I think in wine, and as in every sector, you know, the advice from the IPCC is that we need to lose 43% of emissions this decade, you know, and we're now, you know, 3 years into this decade, and, you know, we've not really made any large leaps, and it's actually just not doable without switching to alternative formats for most of the wine that we drink around the world. So it has to be the way forward at the moment, unless something else comes along. And if we just wait for something else, a new technology, a new format, or some sort of mythical glass furnace, which doesn't yet exist and is probably 20-30 years in the making, if ever, Then we will have missed our chance to be part of it. And if all industries do that, then we're all doomed, I think. So I think it's beholden upon us all, consumers, retailers, and everyone, to do the right thing, and actually, importantly, to tell people what the right thing is.
I think, David Ruff, hopefully that answers your question, because you were asking what the actual problem was with glass recycling. And Oliver has given us a very thorough answer.
Very good. I mean, effectively, you have to burn sand to do it properly, which you know, a melting sand, it's hot. That is a lot of energy. And also, a recycled bottle ends up with a shorter life cycle. So actually, if you're looking at your kind of full life cycle analysis, then you have to build, unfortunately, stuff. We're back to that point of sale that says it's complicated. But, you know, it's a huge undertaking. But Oliver, I think, expressed the technological side very well.
That's brilliant.
And now,
we have had a couple of questions. There was somebody who was a bit up here where I think it was Rupert, you made the suggestion. It shows that there is a sign of, so it shows consumer interest in doing the right thing. Now, actually, I know a little bit of the data around this, because some consumers are very interested. I mean, I tend to look at the Kantar World Panel. Now, I know it's a big global index, it's very large. Actually, eco-actives, people who are genuinely really committed to this, have shrunk slightly over the last few years. I think they've gone from about a quarter, 22% of consumers, down to about 18% of consumers. Eco-dismissers, people who are pretty much actively not interested in this, has slightly grown. And it's around 45% of people are really not into this at all. I mean, we'll go around everybody. I mean, I might as well, Barry, we'll throw this one to you first. Clearly, we've got some sort of segmentation here. How do we tackle people who don't want to have anything to do with this? People who are eco-dismissers, for whom this is a genuine turn-off.
Then you're into the real nuts and bolts of things like cost. As you say, we've got to tackle everyone. And, you know, as Ollie will know, pro rata, packing wine into a can or a bag-in-box is way more expensive than sticking it into a bottle. So that's a real, you know, obstacle for us doing more alternative formats. I would love to see, say, the government help to provide incentives to overcome that. And part of it is also, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and reorganize the industry, the economies of scale are obviously all around 75 cl glass bottles. So it's super, you know, per liter of packing wine into a glass bottle is much cheaper than it is per liter of sticking it into the alternative. So I think with that group, you know, they will respond to the basics, which is financial incentive, way more than saying, look, you're gonna save the planet by buying these alternative formats. I would think that's probably how we're gonna have to tackle it.
And does marketing have a role to play here?
Oh, absolutely. I think Barry's right. There's definitely a way to counter that group, but I think the other important thing to do is to understand the size of that group and reduce it. So there may be people that we won't ever convince, or that it's driven by economics. But we did a piece of work with our customers after the economic downturn, and 7 out of 10 of them said that even if things became more stretched, they weren't going to cut down on sustainable choices in their shopping. So that's really, encouraging. But equally, that is our customer base, and we know that perhaps they're a little bit less price sensitive than some of the others. But I think, as you say, it's marketing, and also it's peer pressure. If we make it look like it's the right thing to do, like you were talking about with your flights, if we just have to make these choices easy and clear. I think the more we can talk about it like this till the cows come home, but actually when it comes to a normal customer who's just trying to buy something quickly at a shelf, we've just got to make it easy and quick. And therefore they'll make the sustainable choice because it's the easy choice. That's the art, is we've got to make that choice easy, convenient, and great value and relevant.
Do you think that there's a role for online influencer community to be seen to be more engaged with this than in glass bottle?
Oh, I mean, it would be really helpful. As I said at the beginning, I think it's, this is about a collective social movement. Equally, I think we could be seeing some, really top end brands, particularly maybe some rosé brands, using more bag in box. We've seen Mirabeau have done one, but actually, could we see well, I wasn't going to say Angelina Jolie, but they're not quite there at the moment, are they? But, you know, all these celebrities, all these kind of high profile wine influencers who have got big followings, even if they, you know, gosh, can you imagine if you saw one of these big actors that's come out with a tequila brand or a rapper, if they put that in a bagging box? So what would that do? You know, there are people who can move the dial of perception and move the dial of volume of communication much more easily than any of us can on our own. So, yeah, if we can persuade one of them to do something a bit radical, that'd be great.
I was hoping that maybe I could move the dial, but then I discovered the Canberra Times reviewed my programme as rather dull for most viewers. So it's unlikely that I'm going to have a huge influence over this.
But you know people who do, Joe. So maybe you need to be the machinator in the background.
Certainly, I can imagine, you know, sort of mirror Val in a
yeah,
can.
Exactly. That's exactly the sort of thing. Yeah, that's and I don't think we're far off. I think that kind of thing will happen and that will help.
Oliver, are you preaching to the converted, really?
With our customers, do you mean?
Yeah.
I mean, to a certain extent, but I think people, you know, actually we find people come to us for different reasons. You know, the number one, when we look at sort of market research with our customers, the number one reason is always quality, but I suppose you have to take that out of the picture. And the environment is then the top reason after that, but it's closely followed by the convenience and other factors. We potentially are. I think actually, it's about making people realise. Again, it's those people that would choose more with their conscience will only do so if they know what the right answer is, and that's what we've got to do. You know, that's where actually product positioning, it's fine on online, but you can only pay to get in front of so many people when you're a small startup. And that's where actually, as Anne said, you know, they've got this great power, and I think product positioning actually in an aisle of a retailer is really important, and it's about number of SKUs. It's not necessarily about the packaging itself, because you know customers won't necessarily walk along and pick up and see on the every single label what the carbon footprint is, if it's available at a single SKU level, which is asking a lot from smaller producers anyway. It's more about if you can guide people to an area where they have wines in packaging that's better for the environment. And actually, talk about simple messaging. It's pretty much that message that you need to give across. Maybe it's about, you know,
I'm just going to butt in there and say it's true, but actually, this is what we're talking about in SWR.
Yeah.
What is better for the environment? Is it carbon footprint? Is it biodiversity?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, so that's where we have to be. Is it labour? Do we pick something on bagging box and then find they've been underpaying their labour? You know, and it's all of that data, all that information that we have to be 100% confident of before we can start using that thing.
I think that's very fair. I mean, I know where I feel my priorities lie when it comes to sustainability, and that's really greenhouse gas emissions. But you know, if you wanted to play it safe, then you could say, you know, reduce greenhouse gas emissions or lower your carbon footprint and point people in the right direction. It comes across with a very similar message. But I think increasing SKUs, and maybe if you have a sort of fine and rare section, have wines in there in alternative formats where available. You know, those sections tend to start sort of just over £10 a bottle. There are wines in both cans and boxes that would suit those sorts of areas, and sometimes that are sold in those same retailers, but they're not in those sections. They're off on their own with the kind of odds and sods and tiny bottles and everything else that's interesting because it's different. And I think that's where we could you know, we would benefit ourselves and society and wine by making it clearer, giving people more options, you know, more choice. And yes, it might be hard for one supermarket to do it by itself, but it may be that going ahead of the crowd gives that supermarket an advantage. Well, maybe it's something that we need to sit down with all retailers and discuss whether there's some targets that can be set.
I think there's truth in all of those things. I know Barry isn't going to want to blow his own trumpet, but he's doing a lot of work at the moment on cans. And we do definitely want to work on the range. We do, as you say, it's making that choice there. Visibility is something Barry and I have talked a lot about, is how we can improve that for our customers. So, yeah, you're right. It's the obvious thing. As ever, it's not as easy as it looks, but we're definitely on the same page with what the ambition is.
Between Barry and who buys cans? Because I mean, Rupert Joy asked a very interesting question about what's the demographic of big buying customers. We'll come back to you in a minute, Oliver. But what's the demographic for environmentally sustainable choices in Waitrose and let's say cans? Do we know if there is even a demographic? It might be a psychographic that's buying into that.
Yeah, that's maybe right. But I think there's definitely been a heartland of the younger consumer who've been happy to and quite open and amenable to, you know, to cans as a format, which has been great. You know, but we've obviously got the Waitrose demographic as well.
This sort of overlays.
I was going to say we don't have as much data as we'd like. I think it's fair to say, but we are definitely looking to run more of that data. I think particularly because Barry's about to do this piece of work with cans, it would be more useful to us to invest in getting that data once we've got that range there. But I would say it's not necessarily just about demographic, but it's also about mission. So what we're finding is that more customers are buying into different missions. So they're buying into bag-in-box and they're buying into can. And we have got some data from which we can extrapolate, or we can guess that this is the case. It's not a foolproof assumption, but I think the data does indicate that actually it's the same customers adding different formats to their repertoire. So they might still buy bottles for some occasions, but they are also buying cans or bag-in-box for others. So, and I think that's really good because it's showing that it's just becoming part of that cultural piece of life again.
Is that one of our keys here? That, I mean, what is it? 40% of drinking occasions with a meal, 20% of drinking occasions in the UK of drinking wine in front of the television. The biggest sort of need state is what people want to go and relax. Actually, is part of the answer here to say, we're not going to convert people as a single megalith, you know, piece. This is about segmenting the market and saying the occasion that is watching the telly after spaghetti bolognese, that is an alternative packaging format. Sunday lunch with the family, okay, you can still have glass of that. I mean, is it about segmenting annals that we
do? I think that's exactly right. I think, and also we have to accept that we're not going to get everyone to switch overnight entirely from one format to another. So actually, if we're getting them to introduce different formats for different occasions, but they're still buying bottles, and maybe they start to understand the benefits of lightweighting, and they're getting to grips with the concept of sustainability in wine, because that is massive. Customers don't really understand what sustainability means in wine, whereas they sort of in chicken they have an idea. It's about free range welfare, not getting some horrendous disease. That's your kind of prime thing, and it's about personal benefit. Whereas in wine, they kind of think that all wine's made in nice, pretty places and it looks green and everyone's happy and lovely and it's a nice family and it's a chateau and all the packaging's the same anyway. But look, there's this bag-in-box thing. What's that? So actually, I think if we start to get that conversation going by getting people to add to their occasions, I think that's probably more likely to have a long-lasting impact than by trying to do something too dramatic that isn't going to work. For me, it's incremental lifestyle change and it's definitely occasion-based.
Barry, what occasion is best for cans?
I think just, you know, again, there's some really good examples, and that is how to get the cut through is, I think if you can get that message across about occasion and the environmental upside. So kind of look, I think cans is, you know, jumping on a train, heading down to the picnic, you know, they chill really quickly. So I think there's some really good examples of where a can is the perfect fit.
It was the benefit to the customer, the environmental benefit. So woohoo, great, that makes me feel good. But actually, what's the direct, immediate benefit to me from buying it in that format? And those exist. We just have to articulate them better.
I can give you one. A pregnant wife. My wife's just had a baby, and the whole way through her pregnancy, I've been drinking cans. It was it's a brand, Juice, DJUCE. I think it's called.
I hope you've been putting that on your Instagram, Joe.
I have been putting it up on my Instagram. So, and now, of course, I've now gone back to bottles because as she sort of comes off the breastfeeding, then we'll be moving back into the real thing. And indeed, bag in box. But no, I have been drinking cans all the way through. And points to, I said also, when it comes to demographics, cans are amazing for much older people. If you're on statins, you can't drink a whole bottle. You just want to go and have a can of wine. And I know quite a lot of, I write for Saga magazine, Saga readers, all over 55, all getting told by their doctors to drink less, but they all quite like premium wine. So actually, they're a really good market for that. I think
Pouches are really good for that as well. They fit, they're really convenient, yeah. And you can have your one glass, same as back in box. You can have, so my occasion, again, not publishable. I know this is being recorded, don't put it in the press, but a quite good occasion is if your husband's doing Dry January, but you're not. So for me, pouches, half bottles, not that we're going to talk about half bottles, cans, all that kind of thing, they're exactly, you know, for the same purpose as you, Joe.
There's the voice of experience. I can see here Simon Rollings just put an interesting one. He said most of our direct customers buy our wines because they want a quality glass of wine at home without opening the whole bottle.
Yes, Erica, I do use my Coravin when I'm having a really nice glass of something, potentially at the weekend. So the Coravin, but I'm not going to go recommending that to my general customer population.
That's brilliant.
I think that's Oliver. A really interesting point, though, Joe, that Simon mentioned, that actually, it's what everyone's touched on, being able to drink in moderation, being able to drink without having to open a bottle. And it can be about quality. I think actually from a retailer, that tiny format, which has that benefit of being, having a lower carbon footprint, but that smaller format's really helpful. You can pick a mix off a shelf. It's really exciting. If you had a shelf full of cans and you can go, well, 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm going to try those. And that I might have spent that on one bottle, or a bottle and a bit. That's really nice. You go home excited to try some different wines. You can have them over a few different nights. You can try them out with a friend on one night. I think that's fun. And the same goes for bag and box. And as you mentioned, that you can have a glass on a weeknight and go on holiday, come back, and then crack on. It's really the only format that you can. You can take a glass out of a box and leave it in the fridge and come back. And actually, if it's just one glass that you've taken out of it, you can come back well over 6 weeks later and it'll still be fine. Boxes last between 4 and 6 weeks.
Who gets a 6 week holiday?
No, well, that's a fairly good point. But, you can forget about it if you've only had a glass out of it, but if you're drinking it sort of regularly, then you've got weeks to drink it, which is really lovely. And I think makes a big difference. So, that occasion actually can just be at home having nice wine. So yes, there are occasions where it's really brilliant, like going on a train, going for a picnic, different formats, depending on the size of picnic. But actually just at home drinking, if you can find the type of wine you want to drink, then it's probably a good thing to do. And it's very, very flexible.
I mean, Erica made a good point there about the Coravin, and it's those kind of wines, the kind of wines that those of us on this call would Coravin. How do we get those in an alternative format?
Yeah. I know we're sort of drawing to a bit of a close, but I'm going to throw a curious sort of question as we come round. I'm going to come to you last on this one, Oliver, because I suspect I know your answer. Barry, what was the last wine you had in an alternative packaging?
A Portuguese white. I had in the fridge. I'm definitely drinking some bag and box and testing the market. I agree with all. I think cans are a great fun way to pick and mix and try a bunch of different things. And I think the branding, I think definitely canned wine, the guys doing branding with canned wines have really shown there's a lot of fun to be had in the wine category, which has been brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was your last alternative packaged wine?
It was Bijou Rosé out of a pouch.
Oh, I know that. Yes.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It sits in the fridge, and then if I haven't got any other drinking wine, you can just have a very small glass, and that's my kind of weekday thing.
It's not very wintry, but it is a pleasant wine, sort of.
My best friend was coming over, to be fair, and she is less kind of articulate about what she likes me, but she does like pink wine, so I was catering for guests.
Well, mine was a mixed pack of the sort of selection pack from Juice. Canned wines, and they were absolutely delicious. I had something different every day, and actually some of them were a little bit on the slight, not funky, but they certainly weren't big producers, and they were kind of small. Oliver, I suspect I know what yours was. I mean, was it market research, or was it something of your own?
It was something of my own, and it was my wife yesterday left the RAF after serving for 25 years. So we had a celebration and opened a box of very, very lovely Sancerre. And we enjoyed one or two glasses each of that last night. And, I'll now continue to enjoy it for, the best part of a week or two, or, however long it lasts. So, that was just last night.
Well, fantastic. Well, thank your wife very much for her 25 years of service and doing the RAF. Now, Tom, I'm aware, I mean, we could sort of carry on all day, but I was aware that this was down for 50 minutes or so, and I don't want to sort of hugely overrun. If there are sort of questions and bits that people want to throw in, we can do. We've got Ruth King says, Canadian Bag and Box. She enjoys the Basque Pinot Noir, and they've done very well branding with zero sugar. Don't get me started on clean wine. That's another session altogether. Just a couple of other bits. Erica, thank you so much for all of your comments. You've been putting all sorts of bits and pieces in, and you've given a big shout out to Juice Wines down there. It was very, very much. Who else have we got down here? Vesa Lampi from Finland, I think. Is that right? I think you've given us some brilliant bits and pieces. But Tom, do you think we've captured this? I think we've sort of got to the point of this is the right thing to do. It's more complicated than it looks, which makes it hard to transmit. But segmentation occasion is possibly a way forwards and getting Brad Pitt to put his wine in cans. Thank you, everybody, for joining. Thank you, the brilliant panel of a great specialist. So I've just sat here and asked questions, which is brilliant, which is why Barry has the MW and I don't.